I'm actually Cynthia Canty. Jack Lessenberry couldn't be here tonight. But it's a pleasure to be with all of you. Based on what I overheard, about 4% of you have any trust in government, and I'm assuming those are the people who already had more than six beers and couldn't figure out what the right part of the clicker to press. We have some people who really know a lot about government, more than I do, with us tonight, and I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say. On my far left, I've always wanted to say that, is Ken Sikkema, who's currently a... Ken Sikkema is one of the most respected men in Lansing. He was, he's a Republican, but he served, I think, six terms in the House of Representatives before term limits, and then he was the Senate Majority Leader. He's now a Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. He was the Senate Majority Leader 10 years ago. Next to him is Chastity Pratt Dawsey, I think one of the... the glamour on the panel. She, I think one of the smartest things Bridge Magazine has done was to hire her. She's a superb reporter, especially in the areas of knowing about Detroit and urban issues and education. She's maybe just about the best education reporter around. Next to me is John Chamberlain, who's a board member currently of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, which attempts to find out for us who owns us. They want to keep it a secret. He's a former political science and public policy professor and a former dean of the Gerald R. Ford School, the very prestigious Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the U of M. So I'm going to... I'm just going to start out by asking them just a couple questions, and then I'm interested in getting to your questions. I'm going to ask, if you want to ask a question, I prefer questions to harangues, please. I will cut you off mercilessly. Just say who you are. You will know who all of us are, so say, you know, who you are. If your name is, you know, Donald Trump and you're in real estate. By the way, thank you all for celebrating Donald Trump's 70th birthday with us tonight, which it is. I think if one measure of how we feel about government, you might want to consider that the voters of Michigan in our presidential primary chose a real estate developer without a day's experience in government who reassured us about the length of his schlong, and a cranky 74-year-old socialist with one shiny suit who no one had ever heard of 6 months ago. I think this is not an accident. So I'm going to start out. I'm going to pose a question to all the panelists, and I'll have them start with John and going around the circle as one example. A couple weeks ago, less than a couple weeks ago, the governor and the Michigan Senate, in a rare show of true bipartisanship, fashioned the plan for the Detroit Public Schools, which was praised by educators, praised by members of both parties, and by members of the Detroit delegation. This was then promptly spat on by the House of Representatives, which voted, which adopted much less money, abolished the commission that would decide what charter schools and what public schools could open schools where, enacted a plan that the Free Press has respected Brian Dickerson said was designed to destroy the public schools, and did so over the objections of the entire Detroit legislative delegation. So, having with that spectacle, how, John, can people be expected to have much trust in the legislature?
I think after that spectacle, they can't have much trust, and I'm sure it went down. I mean, it's been plummeting with the Flint crisis, and I'm sure right. This didn't help. I think it also illustrates the power of money in politics. This was a victory for the DeVos family, who gives... They probably give more than the combined incomes of everybody in this family and your closest relatives. And they paper the House and they paper the Senate with their contributions. And I think in the House, they rolled over for the folks who don't want control of charter schools at all, who believe that, you know, a charter school is better than any other school and shouldn't be regulated. So I think it was a disaster for school kids in Detroit and a disaster of the kind one gets when people can write millions of dollars of checks to influence public policy.
Chastity.
Hi, everyone. You know, I found it interesting that everyone in Detroit, whether they were school teachers, had kids in Detroit, or were on the legislative delegation from Detroit, all said, we don't like this. And the House said, so what? And it's probably the third or fourth time in the past 20 years that this has happened on, you know, regarding Detroit public schools, Detroit's voters and Detroit's delegation saying, please don't do this. And the legislature saying, be quiet, we're going to do what we want to do.
Right.
So how can people have trust in government? I think we're going to see when the House is up for election this year, whether or not the people in their own areas, their own districts, are going to hold them accountable or applaud them by reelecting those who are up for reelection. But it's without a doubt, if you listen to the voices coming out of Detroit, it was one of the worst things that could have happened for the Detroit people, especially when we have local control. Everyone likes local control, right? Well, Detroit has no local control of its schools, hasn't for almost 20 years, and with this, still will not have it. And the legislature is saying, live with it.
Ken, would this have been conceivable 10 years ago when you were running the Senate?
Well, absolutely not, Jack.
Well, that answers that. You want to elaborate?
Well, I don't want my comments to be sort of misconstrued as necessarily disagreeing with either John or Chastity. But I do have a little different analysis, maybe that's the right word, of what's going on and what that vote symbolized. I just think there's a very, very deep ideological divide that showed itself in that vote. We have a very polarized country. We have a very polarized political situation with Republicans and Democrats today. And I guess to answer your question, Jack, the reason it would not have occurred when I was Senate Majority Leader is really quite simple. Number one, as a Republican, we controlled the Senate 20-18, so it was a very narrow margin. And secondly, Granholm, a Democrat, was governor. So we were forced, whether we liked it or not, to find compromise in middle ground. And the situation at the state capitol today is you have a very overwhelming Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate, and you have a Republican governor. So it's really the political dynamics that allowed this to happen. And 10 years ago, because margins were much closer and you had shared power at the Capitol, a Democratic governor, and you had a Republican House and Senate, you were just forced by the nature of that to find middle ground.
Are you saying that divided government might work better?
Yes. And, you know, I mean, I spent so much of my time in the 90s working to get Republican control. But I served for 20 years in the state legislature. In only two of those 20 years did we have complete Republican control of government. You know, Republican House, Republican Senate, and John Engler as governor. And in those 2 years there where we had complete Republican control, the margin in the House was one seat. It was 56-54. And we had, you know, three or four pro-union Republicans in the House caucus. So we just had to find middle ground. It wasn't an option.
Now let me ask all of you, we'll go in sort of descending order. It's very clear that people don't trust government. In fact, even in your own Republican Party, my guess is that 98% of Republican office holders did not want Donald Trump as their nominee nationwide, a very high percentage. This is not who the Republican establishment wanted. What would you do, maybe just in Michigan, what would you do, Ken, what one thing would you do to restore trust in government?
I don't think that's the right question. People clearly don't trust government, but that's been true for a long time. I mean, that's a phenomenon. If you look at the polling data that started in sort of the late 60s and early 70s, and it wasn't just a lack of trust in, or a declining trust in government. It was a declining trust in all big institutions. If you are a Catholic, a lot of Catholics started to not trust the Catholic Church. A lot of people didn't trust GM anymore. So it's a lack of trust in established big institutions, and government is part of that.
Well, you know, I'm a journalist, and we want quick fixes. We don't want anything deep.
I know that.
But is there one thing, obviously, is there something you would do to start?
Well, before you interrupted me,
we do that too in journalism.
I was going to say, the reason I don't think it's the right question, I think there's a question ahead of that that leads to mistrust in government, and that is, what kind of government do you want? What is your expectation about government? If you answer that question, then I think you have a path to answering your question.
I just modify that slightly. Government that works. Government that fixes the roads, which we have not done.
Well, if you're in Flint, it's a government that delivers safe water.
Right.
But in the city I live in Wyoming, Michigan, I implicitly trust my city government because I drink the water from my tap every day and I don't think twice about it. So I do trust my local government, but I still think it's a more important question to ask, what is your expectation? Because you might be a process person. John here is affiliated with the Campaign Finance Network in Michigan, which focuses on the problems of large amounts of unreported money. So that's kind of a process issue. And maybe that would restore your trust in government if that were dealt with. But you might be an issue person. If you're a Tea Party Republican, you don't want government. And so you're going to be sort of an issue person, and that's your expectation. So I think you got to answer the question about what is your expectation about government.
Chastity, from the standpoint of Detroiters.
John is probably a better source to get at what I'm going to hint at. We vote because we expect our representatives to do what they're supposed to do the right thing, be representative and responsive to our needs, and give us services, protect us, things of that nature. We know what we want from government. It's when they don't give us what we want, is when things go bad, when the water is nasty, when the kids aren't educated, that we say, well, we can't trust our government. And if there's one thing, I think when we find out there's cover-ups, either from the DEQ or whomever, that's when our trust gets higher, correct? When the money's missing, when the principals are stealing and the state who was supposed to be watching them did it, that's when our trust gets lower. But where all these things are concerned, there's always money. There's always money that helped get someone elected. There's always money that was stolen. There's always some money involved when we're talking about trust or distrust of government. And if there's one thing that I think really might make a difference, and we'll get at that with our Center for Michigan study, we'll let you know what happened, is campaign finance. When the money goes dark and you can't tell who's giving what to who, people get suspicious and the trust goes away.
All right, John, say whatever you want, but I'm wondering if you, as a student of the process, can address how we can fix that.
Well, I think you could start. I think the place to start with all this is disclosure. Right now, the courts are in the way of doing anything about serious restrictions on contributions, but you can require disclosure. So
the Supreme Court, even when they approved Citizens United, said you can require disclosure. Michigan doesn't.
And the Secretary of State moved to have disclosure behind the issue ads, and it took the Republican legislature about an hour and a half to push a bill through saying over our dead bodies, which meant over her dead body. But you could require disclosure of campaign contributions. You could do whatever we can do about dark money. I mean, the Supreme Court elections, nearly half the money that was spent is unreported. We have no idea where it came from. Probably not much from Michigan. It's traded around a bunch of committees to sort of make it hard to trace. The second thing you could do to increase confidence in the members in the legislature is require some kind of financial disclosure on their part. I mean, Michigan has none of this. Lots of states do. Congress does. Sure, nobody wants to put their bank account out there in front of people, but it's a way to ensure that when people are voting, they're not voting in their own interests. Nobody recuses themselves from votes. It's hard to imagine there aren't votes in Lansing, as well as votes on the Supreme Court, that are interested. That is, money has come from certain people. We often don't know who it is. We don't even require them to let us know. Lots of states do that. So that's not hard to do. It's legal. It's sort of the first step. You take a couple of those, and then you come back with the next one. But at least those, right, I think, are, you know, something that almost everybody would think is a good idea, except for the people who are going to be subjected to it. And both members of both parties probably think it's a good idea. It's not about limits on contributions. But, you know, this is where the parties collude. And in general, in lots of these things, right now the Republicans are controlling things. But over the years, whichever party gets control uses it. And occasionally when you get divisions, there's some question, well, maybe we ought to stop this. But then people think, well, we're going to take the power back next time. Let's hang on and do it. So gerrymandering is like that. Financial disclosure is like that. Reporting lobbyists buying you dinners is like that. It's really not a Republican problem or a Democratic problem. It's, you know, it's the folks inside. It's easier, and it leads people not to trust them. I mean,
well, thanks for cheering us all up, John.
But you know what else, Jack? As a journalist, what about the Freedom of Information Act? You know, when we have to say, please, baby, baby, please, Mr. Governor, can we see your emails? And it's up to him whether to give them to us. And we're not like the rest. There are five or six states like that? And everyone else's information that goes through the governor and legislature is wide open, but not here in Michigan. Why? Why not? Now you have people who are voters saying, should I be suspicious? What have you got to hide?
Exactly. Well, we could go on for hours and hours, but I want to know what's on your folks' mind. So who has a question? And please stand up and say who you are, what your question is, and whether it's for a particular panelist. Somebody, don't be shy. There's a lady right there.
Hi, my name is Alice Andrews, and what really gets stuck in my craw is when the legislature passes a bill and adds some superfluous money aspect so that it's not subject to public referendum.
This is a rather new thing. Let me repeat her question. She's bothered by the current tendency of the legislature to pass bills that are not really money bills, but add a token appropriation. So they can't be repealed by the voters. And what do you want? You ask, what's your particular question about that?
Well, my question is, how do we change that? Is that part of the Michigan Constitution that allows them to do that?
Mr. Chamberlain?
There must be somebody out there who knows the Constitution better than me. I have no idea. It probably is.
I do.
Yeah.
It is a part of the state constitution. The state constitution is very clear that any appropriation bill is not subject to public referendum. During my 20 years in Lansing, we weren't clever enough to figure that out. And they have now clearly, it's become a pattern of behavior to avoid public referendums on things like the new emergency manager law. And there's a long list. In my opinion, it's a clear abuse of that constitutional provision. But, you know, the only way to correct that is, you know, you'd have to mount a petition drive yourself, constitutional amendment, to clarify what the real intent of that particular provision is.
Anybody else want to comment on that? Okay, next question. There's a gentleman standing back there. Who I happen to know.
In my opinion, Frank Wilhelm from Ann Arbor, in my opinion, the fundamental building block of change is to take politics out of the redistricting of legislative districts statewide and congressional. And I'd like to hear the panel talk about whether they agree with that and how do we start moving towards that.
Now, are you saying that we need a independent or bipartisan commission to do it rather than the legislature?
Nonpartisan, right. And we've just joined, my wife and I, the League of Women Voters, and we're going to push from our little corner of Ann Arbor and try to move this stone. It's going to be a big lift, but how do we get this started?
Who wants to start?
I think you're right that it's a problem. It's probably not as big a problem as it's portrayed. I mean, the population shifts are such that there are big concentrations of Republicans around, and any way you draw the lines, they're going to win. But I think it's clear that the Republicans in the last two rounds of redistricting, they've certainly tilted the playing field for Congress a huge amount. So as the Democrats get about half the votes statewide and they get, 40% of the seats or less.
5 out of 14.
Yeah. So I think it's effective and it does preserve the power. In the state legislature, it matters some, but it probably didn't create the current majorities. About the only good thing I could say about term limits is it creates some open seats sometime in the decade. And occasionally, in the last two times, the Republicans have shaved a district a little too close and gotten beat. But the real problem is the money still controls who can run a competitive race, who wants to challenge an incumbent. The money can essentially load the incumbent up and drive the challenger away. And in many of these cases, the party in the minority is putting up a token candidate who spends, $300 on the campaign. And I think we could make a difference and move the majority and minority totals closer together. It also, that poisons the legislative agenda, because in this case, the Democrats in the last two times know they have been screwed by the Republicans. And it poisons the atmosphere. That ought to be out of there so that you're starting with some kind of level playing field, and if one party wins, fine. The other party has some chance of coming back. As it is now, you win, you stack the deck so that the next time it's even harder, and that's a problem. But in order to do it, you talk the legislature into doing this. Republicans are not going to do this. Democrats wouldn't do it if they were in control. And if it was split, they'd wait to see what happens the next time around anyway. So you need a couple of million signatures and probably $5 million, because the folks who like it the way it is have got money. And redistricting is really complicated. Writing a ballot proposal that people can understand. People's attention span is short on this. They don't want to hear me talk for 60 minutes about it.
Well, let me modify that a little bit. Everything you said is absolutely right. But Ken and I were talking before the program about California has gone through what's called a jungle primary, where the top two finishers get into the runoff, regardless of both whether they're Republicans or Democrats. In fact, in California in November, the U.S. Senate race would be between two Democrats because no Republican made it to the finals. Would that be easier, Ken, to get politicians to accept in the state?
Well, I don't know if it's easier than redistricting reform. I mean, we politicians, including me, we might not be rocket scientists, but we're pretty good at knowing what our own interest, where it lies. I'm not a big fan of redistricting reform. I'm extremely sort of lukewarm over it. I mean, it's okay, but it's a huge effort. It doesn't take effect till after the 2020 census. There are other factors, as John said, that I think are contributing immensely to homogeneous districts, including just the way people, where they're moving and where they live. I'm not saying it wouldn't help to create more swing seats, but the other reason I'm kind of lukewarm over it is that in the county where I live, Kent County, which is heavily Republican, although the city of Grand Rapids has two Democratic state representatives, and the outlying county, including where I live, there's, I think, four Republicans. I could create more swing districts in Kent County. But to do that, I really have to divide communities. You know, I got to take the city I live in, Wyoming, which is now represented by one state representative. I'd have to cut it into about three different pieces. And I'm not sure that's very healthy in terms of representation for the city of Wyoming.
So, well, there's other parts of the state where that's been done to other cities.
Yeah, I just, I'm lukewarm over
redistricting. It's complicated stuff, and if redistricting is fixing the system or gaming the system, then you got to know that there's somebody out there trying to game the game. I cover the cities of Michigan, and recently I've heard tell of a city out west where people are flipping because they're outnumbered. They're flipping parties. Now, is that going to be the wave of the future? If we can't get the district in our favor, then just join the other party and take over that way? Who knows? But if it's gaming the system and it's not going to change, you got to know that there are people out there figuring out ways around it.
Okay.
I'll mention on the top two primary, I think that works best for Senate races. I'm not in most of these congressional districts, you know, you'll get two Republicans.
Well, devil's advocate, if you had that now, for example, in Michigan legislative races, wouldn't we be less tendency, wouldn't there be less tendency to have extremely strident liberals and extremely unrealistic Tea Party conservatives in some districts?
Yeah, it probably would. I mean, the usual thing in the primary, you run to the extremes.
Right.
And so you get two extremes, right. And then they race back somewhere near the center. This might allow someone, say, in the Republican Party to be a moderate, hoping to pick up some.
They race near the center if you have a competitive district, but yeah. In Ottawa County, they'd elect a table leg if it were
a
Republican. And where I am, exactly the opposite. You'd elect a Democrat, no matter whether they, you know, were qualified or not. So I'm wondering whether you think that might produce more moderates.
Well, the real question is, if you got an incumbent, will somebody in that party really challenge them? And will the incumbent worry about that, be less right. Extreme? Maybe. I haven't seen enough experience with smaller districts to see whether that works.
Good question. Well, good point. Another question. That gentleman back there in that handsome plaid shirt.
Continuing on the redistricting. Oh, thank you. Continuing on the redistricting vein, no matter who redistricts, we still have sections 2 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act that mandate that, or I suppose implement that we have majority-minority districts. I was writing a paper a few years ago, and I talked to a former Senate redistricting chairman for Michigan, and he was saying how we need to have these districts effectively gerrymandered in order to follow the law. So at that point, what becomes more vital to having representation, districts with majority and minorities, or not having it gerrymandered?
Who wants to tackle that?
I tell you, not that many districts are subject to, at least, I forget whether it's Section 2 or 5.
We're talking about Congress only,
two townships yeah. are right. affected by that. Right. So that gives you a lot of play in the rest of the state. I think you can draw districts that still elect minority candidates that aren't nearly as tortured as the ones, say, in Wayne County and up through Oakland County that are all twisty. You don't need to do that stuff. That was not done just to get a black candidate elected. That was done to get somebody out of that district who was going to help somebody else nearby. And so other states managed to do that. We're not nearly as subject to the Voting Rights Act as other states, and they managed to do it. In fact, the Voting Rights Act may well go away if the court has another bite at it.
I'm curious, too, if anyone wants to respond to this. It's a lot harder to draw majority-minority congressional districts, certainly, than it used to be, because the minority population is more diverse. You know, you have now substantial minority populations in Oakland and Macomb County, which wasn't the case in 1970. Chastity, do you think that requirement is outmoded?
I don't know, because what you have is a segregated Michigan. You know, a
right.
lot of times you have, you know, yeah, you have a lot of Arab people in Dearborn. You have
right.
a lot of black people in Detroit. You have, you know, sprinkling of people now moving towards Macomb. And
right.
and you got Southfield and Oakland. I don't think it is, because we're continuing to lose population in Detroit. People are going different ways and spreading out. So in the next 10 or 15 years, you're going to see probably more of that, the people in the inner ring suburbs moving to the outer ring suburbs.
Right.
So I don't think it's I mean, it is what it is, and it needs to continue. Like, you can't just say, no, we don't need to consider majority-minority districts, and, you know, this thing will fix itself. It never will. We have to always keep our eye on that.
Another question. Where?
Over here.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Hi, up there.
Okay, on our ballot proposals, there's a couple of, I guess, lawsuits coming forward to change and go back to what's supposedly in the Constitution about a four-year time period to collect enough legitimate ballot signees versus the 180 days that our legislature changed to a couple of years ago.
Well, actually, a couple of days ago.
Well, it's weak.
So anyway, so what do you think are the possibilities of us, and is that legitimate?
The possibility of the lawsuit being
going
successful?
Back to the 4 years to collect signees rather than 180 days.
Ken?
Well, it seems to me that whether you're talking about redistricting, which I've already said I'm pretty lukewarm about, or some of these other issues like that, which I assume you're unhappy about that. Why don't you just elect a closer balanced legislature? I mean, you know, like I said during,
or buy eight, one.
Well, 18 of my 20 years at the Capitol, there was some element of bipartisan control, and even the 2 years where we had complete Republican control, the margin was so close that, you know, you were forced to...
Wait a minute. On the Constitution, earlier, you knew what the Constitution said.
Okay, but what's your question? What's your question?
The question is, do you think that this is going to follow through,
based on their argument of 4 years versus the 180 days...
Will the lawsuit be
successful?
Our
legislature changed it, right? There's two lawsuits.
What's your question?
What do you think, because you said you know the Constitution...
An expert.
Is that 4 years going to...
I think the change...
Take precedence over the 180 days.
I get it. I think the change the legislature make is going to be withheld. That's my opinion.
You mean upheld?
Upheld, no. Yeah. I think the change they made, which means you have a specific 180 days to get your signatures... I think that's going to be upheld by the state Supreme Court. That's my opinion.
You know what, though? One thing that we haven't talked about is we talk about we don't trust or people don't trust government and how do we get government to be more responsive. I was in a community last week, a few days ago, actually. They had 2,500 voters, and in the last election, 35 people voted. All of this stuff is changeable when you change your elected officials by voting.
Right. By the way, I'm a bit confused. John, hasn't 6 months been sort of the standard? I mean, that's what people talked about. I had never heard of 4 years before.
I hadn't either. I mean, I thought it was 6 months here, but I don't know what it is in other states. 6 months is pretty quick.
Right. But hasn't the state, the elections board, operated as if 6 months were a rule? Isn't that the case?
And I think that's why they're being sued.
Right.
Zoe seems to know about this.
Yes, of course. Somebody who actually knows something is going to speak.
No, it's that I'm an incredible nerd, and I actually spent this last weekend more hours than I want reading Article 2, Section 9. And basically what it says is that there are 4 years, right, between the governor's race. But since the 1980s, there was a legal precedent that said, no, we are going to take the 180 days. So this is what the argument is about. Do we do the 4 years between governor's races? Do we do the 180 days? But here's what's even better. This is where it gets good. What the Jeffrey Hank, who is the lawyer for MI Legalized, and this comes down from trying to legalize marijuana, what he is saying is, no, actually, there is no time limit. And so you could actually start a signature campaign in 1964 after the last ConCon. And until you get 253,523,000 signatures after no matter how many years, you can put it on the petition. Right.
Even if signees have died?
Well, and this is what gets so good, Jack, is that only the Secretary of State has the valid list. Each county clerk has the valid list of the folks that have signed to decide. And what each of those counties has said is said, well, maybe we'll show you the signatures, maybe we won't. It's going to take us a while. Maybe we'll give them to you, maybe we won't. And so the argument here is whether or not we decide to clarify it or not. And this right here, the four folks who are like, well, this is what I believe, this is what I believe. The fact is, no one has an answer to it. And so what you're going to have is a Ken Sikkema who's going, you know what? We're going to do it like we've done it for decades. And one really smart lawyer decided to change the system. And other folks are going, hey, we're progressives. We want to change the system. And this is where the argument right now between politics is about. How do you read the laws? How do you interpret them? And you can do it no matter what folks think. So I'm going to go sit down because I've said more than enough.
Well, thank you.
But again, I spent way too much reading about this. And if you have any more questions, I'm happy to answer later.
Well, if you all are not now hopelessly confused, you weren't paying attention. I want to jump in here a second, and I'm a little surprised at two words that haven't come up in this discussion: term limits. To what extent are term limits impacting people's trust in government? John, and I want everyone to chime in on this.
I'm not sure how the trust question matches against this. I'm not sure we trust people. One of the reasons we don't trust them is, in your third term in the House, you start having to look for a job.
Right.
And then there's a whole lot of people who want to take you out for dinner and buy you a few drinks.
And if you can push something under the table till after you're gone.
And then you're out the door and you're into a lobby office the next day.
Right.
And so I think that feeds this perception that everybody's corrupt, they're in it for themselves, and term limits, to say nothing of term limits, make it look like amateur hour.
Right.
When the new, it's like a middle school student government thing. The people chairing committees don't know what they're doing. The staff has to take them out of the hall and explain the rules. So I don't think it's worked well for the operations, but I think it does feed the sense that you're in it for the money and you got to get yours now because you're term limited out pretty soon. You don't want to go back home.
Chastity.
The sense that I get is there's a huge dose of buyer's remorse amongst voters because their people are in and out before they learn, like John said, where the bathroom is or how the legislature even works. At the same time, you know, we came here because there was this whole idea that career politicians were keeping other people out of office and just making things, you know, same old, same old. I would be surprised if this doesn't come up in a real way in the next few terms, because we've had such a roller coaster of huge social issues grow through the legislature and so many novices throwing this thing, you know, whether it's emergency managers or, you know, what have you. There's a lot of buyer's remorse amongst voters.
The polling doesn't show much support for doing away with term limits, not nearly as much as people I know who.
Well, Ken, you couldn't have had the career you'd had if it hadn't been, if term limits had been there when you started.
Or the expertise, though.
Well, if term limits were in place when I first ran in 1986, I doubt that I would have run for office because I was on a career path at a big company in West Michigan, and I probably wouldn't have made that sacrifice knowing I could only serve for 6 years in the House. So, but I think from a Republican standpoint, and I've never been a fan of term limits, I voted against it in 92 when it was on the ballot. One of the bad things that has happened in the Republican ranks with term limits is that it has tended to create more homogeneity, less diversity in Republican legislators, because by and large, there are more primaries, right? Every 6 years in the House, The seat is open every 8 years in the Senate. And it just tends to drive more conservative people get elected over time. And so you tend to lose diversity. Let me just give you an example. In 1986, there were five Republican freshmen elected to the state house. I was one of them. Of those five freshmen, two of us were pro-life and three were pro-choice. Now, I'm not making a comment on the issue of abortion. I'm just saying that that can't happen today in the Republican Party. Everybody who gets elected is pro-life. So it's an example of how term limits has sort of driven less diversity or created less diversity in the Republican Party. And I think that's a mistake. I think that's bad for the party.
Let me give you an example of what I mean by buyer's remorse. Maybe 2 months ago, I was on WDET with Tanya Allen, and she would probably kill me if she knew I was telling this story. Tanya Allen is the head of the Skillman Foundation, and we were talking about the bills that were dealing with Detroit public schools that were stuck in the legislature. And what she said on the radio was that there were so many legislators who were just, you know, stupid as hell, or something to that effect. she went back and clarified it and apologized, but what she was getting at was that nobody up there knew what the hell they were talking about when it came to schools. They didn't understand the school aid, the school foundation allowance. They didn't understand how the emergency manager worked in the school. They just didn't get it because they were so new and they were trying to understand so many issues before their terms were up. And here they were deciding what to do with the state's largest school district and $715 million. her whole spiel was more about term limits than it was about the issue of Detroit public schools.
Well, term limits, in fact, Ken mentioned the problem on the Republican side. If you want to look at the Democratic side, you need only look at Virgil Smith Jr. He belonged in the legislature as much as I belong on the physics faculty of Harvard University. He was elected because of his father's name. He'd never really had a job. He had a string of brushes with the law. Now he's sitting in jail where he belongs. And in terms of it, you know, people don't have the time to do all the research. They don't make the time at any rate. And they elect familiar names. So I'm stepping outside my moderator role to say what everybody who really is familiar with this process knows: term limits have been a disaster. But does anybody here realistically think they're going to be changed?
I think there's a chance we'll get to that. The problem is that now if you want to extend them,
right,
it looks, we don't like these people who are in the legislature, right, so why should we let them stick around longer? And if we like the people in the legislature and like what they did, we think, well, term limits don't seem to be getting in the way. So
it's, well, sometimes it takes time to learn your job.
Yeah, it does. And having leadership matters.
Right.
And this really short-circuits that process. That's why extending it probably makes sense. That's sort of the middle ground between,
right,
keeping what we got and dumping the whole,
right,
thing. And
well, the other possibility in Ohio, where I know something,
yeah,
about, you have to sit out a term after two terms, but then you can come back. In Michigan, you can never come back. And that makes that I think works better there. Another question from somebody. There's a lady right here.
Hi, my name is Jen Schlitt. You actually beat me to my question, so thank you for that. But just following up with the term limits, how do you think it's affected the infrastructure problems in Michigan, since people are mostly going to be out the door before?
How has it affected the infrastructure? You mean our tendency to deal with long-term problems?
In general, yeah.
Who wants to tackle that?
In a sense, all of these problems we've got are long-term, and we don't do a good job on any of them, I don't think. I'm not sure I'd lay the condition of the highways on term limits, but they probably play a role in there. There is a tendency to worry about, not unlike, you know, private companies are worried about, so what's the next quarter's earnings going to be, and they're willing to sacrifice something 3 years down the road.
Kick the can.
Wall Street's not.
Well, that's Ken, you were there in 1990. You were in office in 1990 before term limits. Would the road in 1990, would the roads have been fixed in some way other than the way we've not fixed them now?
You know, Jack, prior to term limits, we were perfect.
Good.
We were absolutely perfect.
Well, of course you weren't, you know, still.
I think we're being a little Pollyannish about...
No, but in 1990, before term limits, people expected to be there 20, 30 years.
I understand, Jack, but I was listening to Chastity here quote Tanya Allen, you know, say, no, those legislator was stupid. I remember getting elected in 86 thinking, God, some of these people are really stupid, you know. And they probably thought the same thing of me. Now, to your question, in all seriousness, you know, as a Republican, I believe in lower taxes, okay? I don't think it's a bad thing that it's hard to raise taxes. I like that. I want it to be hard. I want it to be the last resort. Now, there are times you need to raise taxes. In 1997, I was House Republican leader. Engler was governor. We raised the gas tax because we had a road problem. And what is striking to me about 1997 and, you know, a couple of years ago is in 1997, when we raised the gas tax on the House side, half of the Republicans voted for it, voted for a gas tax increase. And every Republican senator, except one, voted for the tax increase, and Governor Engler signed it. Didn't happen 2 years ago. I mean, so it's just...
Right.
The political dynamic has changed dramatically, I'm guessing, on both sides of the aisle, but clearly on the Republican side.
Another question.
I'm Jim Coons from Frankfurt, and we saw the people who don't trust state government, and none of us likes to pay more taxes, but I do think that a key problem in this state is that we don't have enough revenue coming in to support infrastructure in K-12 and higher education. And my thought is that there are some people that can afford to pay more taxes, but not everybody doesn't have to pay more taxes. And I don't know if it's a graduated income tax or some other approach that might be a fair way to pay, and I think gas taxes are very fair to pay because users drive more and they pay more taxes. Is there any way that we can go to some sort of a system that takes the 1%ers or the 5%ers and gets them to pay a little bit more?
Well, let me sort of break down your question. First, are you asking if a graduated income tax would be possible?
Either a graduated income tax or something that allows the more deductions and exemptions for the low income or something.
That's called a graduated income tax. So, Mr. Chamberlain.
You know, I think we do need more revenue. I think, in fact, in the last two administrations, they have, you know, starved in infrastructure, and then the governor didn't have enough clout to do anything about it, got held up by his own party. They have starved revenue sharing to cities, which is why more cities are at the brink, and our solution to that is now broken with the Flint experience.
What would have to happen to have a graduated income tax?
Democrats?
I have no idea.
You'd have to amend the Constitution.
Well, no, you could tax a bunch of things. There are various ways to get taxes. The governor would have to decide, this is important, that the revenue we need for schools, infrastructure, other things really matters, and you'd have to have a governor with enough spine to bust some heads to make it happen. John Engler probably could have done that. He's probably the last person who could.
Well, there's two separate issues here. First of all, Ken, am I right? Would you have to amend the Michigan Constitution? I think the Constitution specifically prohibits a graduated income tax.
It does.
And there's probably not a lot of support for that among Republicans in the legislature. But what about other things, Ken? Are there other things we could do to get more revenue for infrastructure that are feasible and that we should be doing?
Well, I think I've already made my position clear that there are, as much as, you know, I don't want to raise taxes, and I think it's healthy that it's hard to raise taxes, there are times where you have to do it. Roads typically have been a user-pay finance system, as has infrastructure generally. Water and sewer tends to be user paid. A lot of those taxes are raised at the local level. That's a decision that's got to be made there. But I'm not a fan of just sort of unilaterally saying let's raise taxes because we need more revenue. There are times where it's necessary. I will say that.
Would you say roads are one of these times?
Yeah, roads. I think you got to raise the gas tax to pay for roads. I mean, to me, it's sort of a no-brainer. But my brain isn't in the legislature anymore.
Well, let me pin you down because you know more about the legislature than some legislators who are there. No. Had John Engler been in office now, had we not had term limits, would we have done the right thing, done what Snyder wanted to do, and raised the gas tax to fix the roads? That's essentially what the governor proposed.
Look, I voted to raise the gas tax in 1997 when we needed it. I can't imagine if I was there a couple years ago why I wouldn't vote again to raise the gas tax because I think the roads need it.
You heard it here, gentlemen and ladies. It's Sycamore's fault. He left the legislature and the roads fell apart.
But once again, we weren't perfect.
No,
I mean,
right.
One of the things we could have done in 1997 is we could have let the gas tax rise with inflation, and we didn't do that. If we had done that, maybe there wouldn't have been this road crisis of the last 2 to 5 years. So, we weren't perfect, but if you're asking me, in all probability, I would have voted to raise the gas tax a couple years ago.
But the bottom line, you weren't perfect, but there was a problem, and it got solved, at least for the foreseeable future, at that time, which didn't happen this time. John?
So I think you could raise the flat tax rate on income. You can also give various, levels of relief to people who don't make much money. That doesn't require a constitutional change. When the governor came in, he cut tax rates. You can raise tax rates. Public education in the state is sinking fast right down to the bottom. And if you really care about economic development in the state, you can't let your public education go in the trash can.
I want to take just two more.
Real quickly, To the issue of the schools, there are some things that we could do, which is look at how we fund schools. Look at Proposal A. It's, 20-something years old right now? And it's like that can. It keeps getting kicked down the road, and everyone across the state who has a kid or doesn't have a kid, who knows a kid, knows that the school aid fund and the way that Proposal A taxes or doesn't tax certain people is not working.
I want to take at least one more question. Somebody at the bar, people at the bar. Let's start. Two people at the bar. First, the guy with the old English D. And then the lady behind him.
All right. So thank you, Mr. Lessenberry, and the panel for joining
us. Tell us who you are.
My name is Robert. I'm from Canton. What kind of ideas does the panel have in regards to the mixed results of the emergency manager law? There have been obviously successes in terms of the city of Detroit, the bankruptcy itself, versus the Flint water crisis, obviously a failure. What would the panel like to see in regards to the emergency manager law that balances the interests of the state government versus the local?
That's an excellent question. John.
I can't write chapter and verse. We have one of the more extreme emergency manager laws. Basically, somebody takes over and they can do everything. Other states have got some intermediate things. I'd go find out what they do. I'd look at individual experiences of cities. I do something about not pushing cities in that direction, which I think, state policy has done in recent years, so we don't need as many of them. But I do think you need a balance between, governments that are circling the drain and will continue to do it until they drop, and taking them over, removing politics from in local control. And I don't know who's got that secret sauce.
Do they need more oversight?
Absolutely.
Yeah, they need more oversight. They need some kind of participation, some reason for there to continue to be public discourse in the jurisdiction, right, other than somebody's going to run it as if it was their company.
Chastity.
So what you have in North Carolina is you have a state that has an entire department whose job is to make sure the municipalities don't get in such a bad way. There's a lot of work done on the front end to make sure that the state doesn't have to come in and give you money or bail you out. And then you have states like Rhode Island where once you get in a bad way, the people who were or are the elected officials are kept in the process to help clean it up so that there's buy-in on the local end and not, we hate you, go away, Mr. Bad, big bad state. You know, the local officials who did a bad job stay around and help fix the problem and move the city forward so everybody's working in tandem toward the same goal. So while we have one of the most restrictive emergency manager laws in the country, it also doesn't do on the front and the back end what other states do to make sure that everybody rolls in the same direction. And that makes a difference because we have a place like Highland Park. It had an emergency manager. I think it had to. And now there's a huge water bill that they have that's threatening to just dissolve the whole city. Then you have Inkster Public Schools. It had an emergency manager, and now it doesn't exist because it went back into deficit. Because these two mechanisms are not at play in our law. There's no front end, and there's no local control buy-in that's built into our law.
Ken?
Well, I co-chaired the Flint Water Advisory Task Force that investigated what happened in Flint, and we identified three deficiencies in the emergency manager law that we believe could be corrected without jettisoning the whole law, because you do need some form of state receivership. Virtually every state does. The three deficiencies: the emergency managers don't have the expertise necessary to run a city. They have financial expertise. The state can supplement that, as some states do. Number two is you lose the checks and balances that representative democracy provides, and that's correctable. You could allow for the appeal of some of the emergency manager decisions to another panel, another body. And then the third deficiency is people lose their voice. You need a structured way so that people feel they are being heard and their voice still matters, because, as John pointed out, our emergency manager law here in this state is very draconian. I mean, they're basically dictators. So you need a structured way so people still legitimately feel and have some kind of voice. You can correct those three deficiencies and maintain the emergency manager law.
Great. The final question, this young lady here at the bar.
Let's go back to the gas tax. Now, there was a ballot proposal to have a gas tax, but then you heard, well, we're going to add this onto it, and we're going to add this onto it, and that's why it got defeated.
You're talking about the constitutional, the proposal that we voted on.
Right,
May.
The proposal. It got defeated because all the legislator wanted to add their little
it was referred to ideas. As a Christmas tree, yeah.
Yeah, right. Why can't we have a tax that's straightforward, that doesn't get add-ons to it? More people would vote for a tax if they knew exactly what they were voting for. Now,
you're suggesting we do something sensible, logical, and easily understood?
Yeah.
Anyone
want to
comment
nice.
On that? That's a very radical idea. Anyone want to comment on that?
I'm all for that.
Well, just a minute here.
The voice of experience.
I understand your frustration, but Proposal A, which the voters adopted in the spring of 1994, was very complicated.
Right.
Proposal A was extremely complicated. The difference was Proposal A gave you a choice. We were going to, at that time, fix the way we financed public schools, meaning we were going to get away from the property tax. And you had a choice. You could vote for a sales tax increase or an income tax increase. But saying we weren't going to fix the problem was not given to you as an option. That was the difference between this gas tax proposal that you're talking about. You just voted no and the problem wasn't fixed. My view is they should have done something like Proposal A. So you had to make a choice as to how to fix the roads, and not fixing the roads was not a choice.
One fast follow-up, fast.
What 20%? Where does that money go? Where is that high gas tax? Where does it go?
Is her assumption correct? We have one of the highest gas taxes in the country. I don't think that's the case.
No,
I think we're sort of in the middle, toward the bottom middle of the pack, and it goes clearly. It's not generating enough money to fix our roads. That's the whole problem. Well, you know, you are a great group. You stayed overtime. And I hope you'll be willing to stand around and, you know, maybe talk with our guests if they can stay a little more. But please give yourselves a round of applause for enduring this. Everything we've done. And now I want to have a word from our sponsor.
Thank you. I'm hardly the sponsor. How about a big round of applause for all of our panel? Gave up their Tuesday evening to come out and share their expertise with you on this topic. Thank you very much. A big thank you again to the great folks here at Brewery Becker for hosting us tonight. Let's give them a round of applause as well. Hope you'll come back and visit again some other time. And if you're interested in future Michigan Radio Issues and Ale events, just check out our website. We do have a discussion coming up on the same topic. If you happen to be in Kalamazoo in 2 weeks, you can come for that. If you want to find out about other Issues and Ale topics and other events going on, you can also sign up for Michigan Radio's newsletter. Just go to our website, click on the Connect tab, and sign up for our newsletter and keep it informed that way. Thank you all for coming out, and drive safely.